Welcome to the Seattle Astronomy Podcast, focused on space and astronomy news and events out of Seattle, with particular emphasis on items of interest to amateur astronomy enthusiasts. I'm Greg Scheiderer, your host, and I'm also the writer of the Seattle Astronomy blog at seattleastronomy.com. Our fun event of the last week was the 11th meeting of Astronomy on Tap Seattle. This is a monthly event organized by graduate students in astronomy at the University of Washington. It is held at Bad Jimmy's Brewing Company in Ballard. The gatherings typically feature a couple of guest speakers, plus trivia games, prizes, and plenty of time for a Q&A with gathered scientists. And they have excellent beer at Bad Jimmy's, I just might add. Last week's Astronomy on Tap was the radioactive edition. Now, radioactivity gets a bad rap as being dangerous, and it's true, it can be harmful, but just like beer, it can be good for you in moderation. In fact, Rory Barnes, a professor in the Department of Astronomy and the Astrobiology Program at the UW, couldn't resist the temptation to do a little in-depth analysis of the brew we were drinking at Bad Jimmy's during his presentation.
Carbon is pretty interesting, of course, as far as astrobiology is concerned. It's the backbone of life on Earth. And, we all have a lot of carbon in this, and I couldn't help but wonder about how radioactive is a pint of beer. Well, we can kind of figure this out pretty early. Should I be a little careful here? Well, you know, most beer is like 97% water, but, a fine craft brew like here at Bad Jimmy's is more probably like 90% water. We get a lot more flavor in there. So there's actually going to be a lot more carbon in our beers today, which could be a problem. But let's move on. So if we assume that of the remaining 10%, about 10% of what's left is carbon, and that means about 1% of your beer is carbon, which is about 4.5 grams of carbon. All right, so I mentioned that there's not a lot of heavy carbon on the Earth, and I meant that. Only about 10 to the minus 10% of carbon on Earth is in this radioactive
form. That's
going
to be several,
so you're probably thinking that that's not too much to worry about. But let's go through the math. So let's do a little chemistry and work out some Avogadro's numbers and molar fractions and things like that. And you come out with that there's 200 billion carbon-14 atoms in your beer. You are all drinking radioactive beer. Carbon-14 has a half-life of 5,730 years, so you would really want to know is how many decays are going on, and you can do a little math and work out the calculus, and I'm just going to tell you the answer. It's by chance, by coincidence, it's about one decay per second in your pint of beer.
Milk is
so,
worse.
Cheers to Bad Jimmy's and their radioactive beer. Thank you.
I will note that nobody poured their beer out upon hearing about this radioactivity. I was enjoying a red IPA that may well have been even a little more radioactive than some of the others. It was that good. Now, the point is that the Earth contains a lot more carbon than does a pint of beer, and the radioactive decay of heavy elements, especially uranium, thorium, and potassium, generates quite a bit of energy in the planet's interior. This drives geological activity, which also can be bad. Volcanic eruptions and major earthquakes can be killers. But Barnes noted that geological activity is also essential for our very survival.
The radioactivity in the Earth powers this process of plate tectonics that causes the Earth's surface to shift around. And this, in turn, actually regulates the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. So carbon dioxide is, of course, notorious now because it is the main driver of climate change on Earth. So it's really important that the planet does a good job of keeping it from not building up to too high of a level or dropping down to too low of a level, because then our Earth will not be habitable. And the way that this process works is that basically, if you consider the atmosphere, there's carbon dioxide in it that's in contact with rainwater, and it actually gets dissolved in the rainwater, and the carbon dioxide rains down. It fills the streams and the rivers, and the water flowing down dislodges minerals in the sea in the riverbed, and it drags all of the carbon dioxide and minerals into the ocean. Once in the ocean, they react, and the carbon dioxide often forms bonds with minerals like carbon and forms rocks called calcium carbonate. And rocks don't float in the ocean, they sink to the sea floor, and there they sit for a very long time, but the slow movement of the plates pushes these carbonate rocks to the continents and to regions where there is subduction, like the Cascadian subduction zone off the Olympic coast. And from there, these carbonate rocks are driven deep down into the earth where the temperatures are hotter. The carbon dioxide is released as the rocks melt. They're trapped under the earth until there is a volcanic eruption. The carbon dioxide is then re-released into the atmosphere where the whole process can begin again. So this is really important because without it, the carbon dioxide would either build up and our planet would roast, or maybe we get it all drawn down and our planet would freeze. So without any kind of internal energy, our planet would not be habitable. But you need to have the right amount of internal energy. You know, if it's too much, you're not going to be in a good place. If it's too little, it's all similar.
Barnes said Earth is in the sweet spot. Mars generates less than half the internal energy of Earth and is geologically dead. Jupiter's moon Io, on the other hand, generates about 5 times as much internal energy, and it is a wildly volcanically active place. So again, all things in moderation. As an astrobiologist, Barnes is particularly interested in finding extraterrestrial life, with a bent for choosing the smartest places to look for it, places where life is most likely. Thus, he says that a great way to make that call would be to determine which exoplanets have a suitable amount of internal energy from radioactive decay. The bad news is that we don't yet have a way to look inside a rock that may be hundreds of light years distant. Barnes noted that the James Webb Space Telescope, which NASA hopes to launch next year, will be able to examine exoplanet atmospheres, so we are getting closer, but the science isn't quite there yet for exoplanet geology. Also at Astronomy on Tap, UW postdoc Charlie Sicari gave a talk about how she determines the ages of stars by examining the spectra of their light and looking for the signatures of elements with extremely long half-lives. Uranium-238, for example, has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, which is about the age of our sun, whereas thorium-232 has a half-life of around 14 billion years. As such, it could be used to determine the ages of the oldest stars in the universe. You can read about this event on seattleastronomy.com. The next Astronomy on Tap Seattle is scheduled for February 17th. You can follow AOT Seattle on Facebook or Twitter to keep up to date on their events, or track them on the Seattle Astronomy Calendar. Speaking of events, there are several of note coming up. The Seattle Astronomical Society's annual banquet is this Saturday, January 30th, and the guest speaker will be Mr. Eclipse, Fred Espenak. Espenak will talk about how to get ready for viewing the Great American Solar Eclipse of 2017. By now, you've probably heard that this total eclipse of the sun will zip across North America in August of next year. This will be the first total solar eclipse visible from the lower 48 since 1979. That's already generating a lot of buzz. The SAS banquet is sold out. The play Silent Sky opens this week at Taproot Theater in Seattle's Greenwood neighborhood. Silent Sky was penned by San Francisco playwright Lauren Gunderson and will be directed by Karen Lund. The play is the true story of Henrietta Leavitt. She's the American astronomer whose work on Cepheid variable stars gave us the tools and insight we needed to accurately figure out the distances to other galaxies. The show runs through February 27th. The Museum of Flight will hold its Astronaut Remembrance Weekend this weekend, with videos and exhibits looking back on the men and women who have perished exploring the heavens. It's a little odd that America's 3 space catastrophes have all happened at this time of year. Thursday, the 28th, will be the 30th anniversary of the explosion of the space shuttle Challenger. The Apollo 1 astronauts died in a fire on the launch pad on January 27th, 1967, and the shuttle Columbia Columbia broke up on reentry on February 1st in 2003. On Saturday at 2:30 at the Museum of Flight, NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador Ron Hobbs and the museum's Challenger Learning Center coordinator Tony Gondola will give a presentation remembering the astronauts who paid the ultimate price in the line of duty. Tacoma Astronomical Society will hold one of its free public observing nights on Saturday at 7:30 p.m. It'll be at the Fort Steilacoom campus of Pierce College. The Tacoma, Olympic, and Spokane Societies all have their regular meetings next week. That's it for this edition of the Seattle Astronomy Podcast. Keep up with day-to-day news on our blog, find astronomy events on the Seattle Astronomy calendar, and check out the Seattle Astronomy Store for our recommendations for astronomy books, gear, software, and gadgets. It's all at seattleastronomy.com. The Seattle Astronomy Podcast is copyright 2016 by seattleastronomy.com. Our theme music is Aboard the Alien Craft from the album Symphony for Spaceman by Steve Combs and Delta Is. It's on freemusic.org and used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Clear skies. I'm Greg Scheiderer. Thanks for listening.